Welcome to Whiskey Cask, Cask Strength Conversation, featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 430 for June 23rd, 2013. Coming up in a few minutes.
I made a joke about lining up on a table things like a bowl of ice, a can of Coke, a bottle of soda, a bowl of lemon slices, and a pipette in a little glass of cool, clean water, and they have to choose the one implement appropriate for, you know, enhancing a scotch, and anybody who reaches in the wrong direction doesn't get in.
Malt maniac Rich Howard is kidding, of course, but he was given a task many of us would love to have, or maybe not. He was asked to pick the whiskeys for a wedding party with a budget that reached $15,000 and an emphasis on quality, not quantity. Which whiskeys would you pick in that situation? Rich will tell us what he picked out later on Whiskey Cast In Depth. I'll also have the calendar of events, your voice, and the one I'm tasting this week department, all on this week's Whiskey Cast.
Whiskey Cast. Proudly brought to you by Redbreast. The definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Join the stillhouse at singlepotstill.com and receive an exclusive whiskey tasting journal.
Let's start off with the week's news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie. First off, work is finally getting underway on another new distillery in Scotland. It's one we talked about a lot here on Whiskey Cast several years ago, but the plans seemed to die down for a while. Site preparation has started in Huntly on the site of Duncan Taylor's planned distillery. Ewan Shand has been wanting to build this distillery for a long time, but issues with threatened wildlife at the site held up the project. I talked briefly with Ewan this weekend. He's in France at the 24 Hours of Le Mans, and cell service in the area kept us from recording an interview. We're going to catch up this week. I'll have more details at whiskeycast.com and on next week's episode after we talk. By the way, Ewan is likely to be in France again a year from now as well. Duncan Taylor's Black Bowl Blended Scotch has signed on as a sponsor for the Ecurie Écosse Sports Car Racing Team. They're competing in British GT and European Le Mans Series races this year to get ready for the 24 Hours of Le Mans next year. The Huntly Project is one of several distillery projects that have been getting assistance from the Scottish Government recently. Economic development grants have been awarded this week to Adelphi's new distillery on the Ardnamurchan Peninsula, Ballindalloch in Aberdeenshire, the Falkirk Distillery, Aniston Farms in Angus, and a new distillery planned in the town of Glenrothes in Fife, not to be confused with Glenrothes Distillery in the Speyside town of Rothes. Now, let's update our story from the last episode on the distribution shakeup at the Edrington Group. As I reported last week, Edrington is ending its longtime partnership with Remy Cointreau in the U.S. market. This week, Edrington confirmed its plans to set up its own division in the U.S. to handle sales and marketing for its whiskeys, rum, and vodka portfolio starting next April. Edrington is also setting up a similar division in Southeast Asia and will set up a joint venture with its current partner in the Middle East and Northern Africa. In other news, James Espy helped found the Keepers of the Quake to honor people for their services to the Scotch whiskey industry. That was just one of many things he's accomplished over the years, and now he's being honored for his services to the Scotch whiskey industry. Queen Elizabeth has named Espy an Officer of the Order of the British Empire, or an OBE, in her annual birthday honors list. Last year, a bottle of Hankey Bannister blended scotch from the 1920s was discovered in the UK. Inverhouse, an international beverage, got its hands on the bottle and put master blender Stuart Harvey to work recreating it. Now, 5,000 cases of Hankey Bannister Heritage Blend are being shipped out around the world. The blend uses slightly older and peatier whiskies than the regular Hankey Bannister expressions. Finally, Australia's most ardent whiskey lovers put their nosing skills to the test Friday night in Sydney at the annual Australian Malt Whiskey Tasting Championship. More than 60 competitors had to nose and identify 8 different whiskies, and in the end, the winner was a repeat champion. Malt maniac Craig Daniels of Adelaide took top honors for the 4th time and won a spot on the Scotch Malt Whiskey Society Australian Chapter's upcoming whiskey tour of Tasmania. James Tate came in second, and won $1,000 worth of Society whiskies for his collection. Ian Tittman was third. He won a $500 gift certificate from the Oak Barrel Whiskey Shop in Sydney. The championship was sponsored by Glenmorangie, William Grant & Sons, and the Oak Barrel. Plans are already in the works for next year's competition. You can keep up with the latest whiskey news all week long at whiskeycast.com. But for now, that's the week's news.
The news is brought to you by Glenmorangie. Help us select the next Glenmorangie single malt whiskey with the Glenmorangie Caskmasters project. Sign up online through the Glenmorangie Facebook page or on glenmorangie.com.
Your voice is sponsored this week by Highland Park. First off, I know we have a lot of listeners in the Calgary area and the rest of Alberta. The area has been hit hard by flooding the last few days. Here's hoping all of you make it through safely. Speaking of Canada, Ed Vargas posted this note on the Your Voice page at WhiskeyCast.com this week. Here's what he had to say. Whistlepig, Masterson's, and even going back a ways, Bush Pilot, what do all these great American-released whiskeys have in common? All Canadian-produced whiskey sold in America and all exceptional. So what's with the Canadian whiskey industry? They probably have some of the oldest whiskey stocks in North America because they did not have prohibition, but we don't see any of it. What we do get is repackaged and sold to us by American companies. Some of the best rye whiskey is coming out of Canada, but yet I don't see Canadian companies selling us the same product they sold to Masterson's and Whistlepig. What gives? Is it a failure on the part of Canadian whiskey industry to forecast the demand, or is it just an easier way to make a buck by selling in bulk to American companies? I would really like to rummage around some of the warehouses of the big Canadian producers. I bet there's stuff in there they forgot about. Well, first off, there is nothing in those warehouses that they've forgotten about. Distillers are required to account for every single barrel in their bonded warehouses, so those stories about lost barrels are marketing hype for the most part. And let's clarify what Ed had to say about Prohibition. During that dark time in American history, most Canadian distillers were selling just about everything they could make to bootleggers, so it's not as though they had a lot of whiskey stockpiled for later years. The thing to keep in mind is that most distillers, not just in Canada, but all over the world, tend to focus on volume, and for the most part, they don't focus on small boutique-level batches like Masterson's and Whistlepig. When you're selling millions of cases of whiskey each year, the number of casks that would go into a Masterson's or Whistlepig are barely a blip on the spreadsheet, and most of the time those casks wind up getting blended into the distiller's own brands. That is starting to change a bit with whiskeys like 40 Creek and some of the new whiskeys coming out of Corby, and if consumers keep buying the boutique brands like Whistlepig, Masterson's, 40 Creek, and the Corby whiskeys, we'll see the bigger distillers stepping up their game as well. If you'd like to respond to Ed's comment, you can post your own thoughts on the Your Voice page at WhiskeyCast.com, or you can email me. My address is comments@whiskeycast.com. And this week's Your Voice is brought to you by Highland Park.
My name is Daryl Haldane, Global Brand Advocate for Highland Park. Go onto our website at highlandpark.co.uk and upload your photo at Inner Circle to have your face on the walls of the Highland Park Distillery.
Time now for the calendar of events brought to you by Laphroaig. If you're vacationing in Speyside this summer, there's a whiskey nosing and tasting session every Wednesday night at the Commercial Hall in Dufton. The series kicks off this week with a tasting of single malts from the Glenrothes. The Isle of Arran Malt and Music Festival is this coming weekend at Arran Distillery in La Crenza, Scotland. And the Whiskey Show 2013 is also this coming weekend in Sydney, Australia. The Los Angeles Scotch Club will hold its annual Peatin Meetin event on Saturday at UCLA's Sunset Canyon Picnic Area, and the guys from Single Cask Nation will lead a tasting on Sunday at Temple Menorah in Redondo Beach, California. Against the Grain in Dublin, Ireland will hold a tasting on July 4th. Appropriately, American whiskeys will be on the menu that night. The Mozambique Whiskey Festival will be on July 4th and 5th in Maputo. And the Miner's Delight Inn in Atlantic City, Wyoming, has its first Friday single malt tasting coming up on July 5th. You can find details on more than 250 different whiskey events coming up over the next year at WhiskeyCast.com. Just look in the pub section. The calendar is brought to you by Laphroaig. Take a virtual distillery tour at Laphroaig.com. And while you're there, become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Islay.
WhiskeyCast. brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. In conversation with Barry Crockett, master distiller, Redbreast single pot still Irish whiskey.
I think that where celebration of a special event is concerned, you can't really surpass Redbreast in terms of the single pot still style. And certainly for any, say, special family occasion or when people call to the house, people would normally maybe expect something a little bit better. And in that case, I would present a Redbreast.
Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Those in the know Redbreast.
Whiskey Cast In Depth is brought to you by Woodford Reserve. Here's a challenge for you. You're asked to pick the whiskeys for a wedding party. The father of the bride says he wants quality, not quantity, and he's willing to spend whatever it takes to make sure everyone has a good time that night. Which whiskeys do you pick, and where do you start? It's not just a hypothetical challenge. Malt maniac Rich Howard had to do just that for a wedding party coming up this Friday night in Minnesota, and he had 2 weeks to pull it off. Tell me how you got roped into picking the whiskeys for this guy's wedding. First of all, without giving his name or any of those details, tell me about this guy and how he talked you into picking the whiskeys for the wedding.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll use first names only to protect the innocent. But just as a quick background, I'm fairly constantly asked for, smaller type, gigs to, for example, recommend a whiskey for somebody's boss at work or for somebody's husband for their birthday. So it's fairly common that somebody will come to me and say, I'm having a party, and I have this much money, what whiskey would you get? Or I have a gift certificate to a local liquor store. So, I've developed a bit of a repertoire and a reputation for kind of guiding people towards whiskeys I think they and or their loved ones might like. And it just so happens I have a friend and neighbor whose name is Paul. And Paul and I have spent many a night together, sipping fine scotches or a nice beer or something like that. And for some time now, he's been trying to introduce me to this other guy named John. And it's never quite worked out that we've met, which is kind of an interesting backdrop. But then suddenly, just about a week ago, I get an email from John kind of following up one of the threads where we were actually trying to get together and saying, I'm a little remiss in sending this out so late, but my daughter will be getting married in a couple of weeks, and I would kind of like to assemble a nice selection of top-shelf scotches and have a little secret tasting room in my office in the basement to which select guests can be invited. So it's kind of like somebody I've been meaning to meet for a while. It just hasn't quite happened. But, I mean, through the recommendation of Paul when he was looking for scotches for his daughter's wedding, he turned to me and I gladly accepted.
He gave you a budget, right?
Yes, he gave me an initial budget. When the request first came in, it was completely ambiguous in terms of, would you help me assemble a nice selection of scotch? Well, most people would know that that can encompass a great many things. And so half jokingly, I wrote back and I said, what are the terms and conditions here? I noticed that the Glenmorangie Pride is on sale at a local vendor for about $3,000. And of course, it was tongue in cheek. I was half joking. So John did come back and say, it's my one daughter, her one wedding, and if we were to go to $5,000, that would be okay. And I was like, okay, $5,000 is a good amount to work with. And I started assembling a little list of thoughts that I had about what I might want to purchase for that much money. And he came back and he specified. He said, I don't want just like a slew of bottles. He said, buy fewer bottles and err on the side of quality. So I started bouncing a few ideas off him. And then he said, well, let's make it $6,000. And then next thing you know, I got an email that said, if we were to go to $10,000, that would be fine. So suddenly my budget was $10,000 for buying single malt scotches, and I will note that since then we have gone north of $15,000. So it's been a lot of fun.
So you've added to the list that you actually posted on Facebook earlier in the week then, right?
Correct. Yeah, I had put a note out on Malt Maniac and Friends knowing that, you know, it's always fun to drop a few lures in the water and see, you know, see what churn you can get. And so, yeah, I did post a preliminary list of things I had purchased. But since then, we talked a little bit, and he also wanted to add in some, you know, some nicer kind of bourbons and ryes just in case. Obviously, not everybody is interested in the single malts, and he thought it would be nice to have also a very wedding-worthy contingent of other types of whiskey. And so I did buy a few of those, and it just turned out that a local proprietor gave us a really nice deal on some basically collectibles like the Pappy Van Winkle 20-year. And so once we got the list back, we wanted to support him further. So we ended up tossing in a few other bottles. So, yeah, since the list I posted, I think I'm probably up to north of 25 bottles and, like I said, north of $15,000.
So you mentioned your source in the Minneapolis area. How did you wind up, before we go through this list, how did you wind up acquiring all of these whiskeys? Because a number of these are not available in the U.S. normally, right?
That is correct, and that's a great question because one of the first things I needed to consider was the sourcing of the whiskeys, because I knew that for that kind of budget, not that there's a shortage of whiskeys in the U.S., but when you start thinking of, you know, just like world-class bottles you might want to bring down for that kind of money, frankly, you're just not going to find them in the U.S. At all. As one little sneak preview, I was able to pull down the original Lagavulin 21-year-old 1985. And although I was able to find one in the U.S. about 5 years ago, you would be hard-pressed to find one now. So I knew that I would need to go overseas for at least some of them in order to get the bottles. You know, given free reign, I had some strong opinions on what type of whiskeys I would want to have. And so, but then I also was aware that shipping regulations have changed recently in the UK, and, you know, shipments have been known to get hung up in customs for a week or two. And so I kind of realized if I put all of my eggs in that basket that, you know, I could very well come up on, you know, and with the two-week time frame, too, given 2 months, I wouldn't have worried at all. But given 2 weeks, I knew that I had to move fast and make sure the whiskeys could get here. So the first thing I kind of had to do was divide the list roughly in half and think of things in terms of Scotch regions, profiles of the whiskey, the casking, are they sherry cast or bourbon cast, are they peated, are they lowlanders? I had to go through all this thinking, and if, for example, if I bought a bunch of sherried Islas from the UK and then bought a bunch of Highland whiskeys from the US, we could be short of, you know, Islas and sherried Islas at the night of the wedding. So the first thing I kind of had to do was try and get equal representation on either side of the pond without duplicating, and given my hope that they all actually do show up, that there wouldn't be any like, well, this is pretty much exactly the same as that. So it was actually a little bit of a puzzle. And so using that approach, I was able then to kind of identify the whiskeys I wanted to get from the UK, and I just built out a little spreadsheet where I had like columns with in and out, and I would say, okay, if this one's in, this one's out because it's over budget or it's too similar, but then if I found a similar bottle in the U.S., which I felt was safer for shipping, then I would say, okay, I'll source that, you know, locally or from the U.S., and then I don't need to order that from overseas. So I literally had like this balance sheet of, you know, UK whiskeys, US whiskeys, this in, this out, and all kind of trying to balance them all out towards the final tally. So that's kind of the decision process I used.
You know, with that kind of a budget, you could have just flown over to either the Whiskey Exchange in London or Gordon and MacPhail in Scotland and just brought them all back with you and cleared them through customs immediately.
That is probably true, but then also you never know. I've gone over to Scotland a few times in the last couple of years, and I've brought back a handful of bottles and fortunately have sailed through customs, but it's the type of thing that, you know, one, there's a risk, and, you know, two, I know the question is probably tongue-in-cheek, but, you know, I figure if it's going to be $1,000 to fly to Heathrow, I would rather put that $1,000 towards the Lagavulin 21. So I did my level best to ensure that the budget went only towards the whiskey. But to that point, it was funny. Once I did my final calculations, I think my initial breakdown came to $10,250 plus or minus based on, you know, obviously the exchange rate. And so I sent John an email and said, you know, I have fulfilled my duty and I have budgeted $10,000 worth of single malt. And then I said, you know, keep in mind that this budget is for whiskey only because I'm not going to be accountable for shipping and customs and taxes and insurance, because I just felt that my job was to be a procurer of fine single malts and not to be in an accountant. And so I did take free rein only to include whiskeys in the budget.
Before we get into the whiskeys themselves, any retailers you want to give special mentions to for going above and beyond here?
Absolutely. The two that I will tag most strongly are the Whiskey Exchange in the UK. Ever since the shipping regulations have changed, they have really bent over backwards to accommodate U.S. customers. What they do is they actually build in the customs process right into the purchase, so that when you order from them, you pay the customs fee and they fill out the form for you. So by the time the shipment comes in, that work is done, the money is paid, and you're far less likely to be flagged for, you know, the shipment or have it hung up in customs as they try and figure out what it is. They streamline that process for you ahead of time. So, and they also, I was in touch with Tim Forbes over there, and he really worked hard to expedite my order, knowing that, you know, even with an expedited order, we are looking at a pretty tight time frame coming around. And I'd also like to give a pretty huge mention to a local liquor store here in the Twin Cities called Merwin Liquors. Louis Dotchess is the proprietor, and he really set us up with a number of really special bourbons and ryes that he had around that he really, you know, thought would be best served being open at a, you know, a joyous occasion like a wedding where people would enjoy them. He has a similar kind of ethic as mine, that fine whiskeys are meant to be enjoyed in good company and not to, you know, sit on the shelf and make their way to auction. And so he was pretty pleased to have a few highly sought after whiskeys that that he was willing to furnish for the wedding. And then in turn, like I said, we did turn around and I ordered some other, you know, some other single malts from him as well, because we really enjoyed the service, wanted to give him some more business. And, you know, we also identified he had a few single malts that we wouldn't mind having.
Okay, let's go through the list, and let's start off with the Islas first. What did you pick from the Isla region?
Okay, my forte is I love the heavily shared Islas. So a few of the crown jewels, I was pondering a number of high-end bottles, including like the Ardbeg Provenance or the Lagavulin 30. With a 10,000-plus budget, really a lot of just world-class bottles come into play. Ultimately, what I lean towards is the crown jewel is the Laphroaig 27-year-old 1980. That's the one that comes from five Oloroso casks. There's 972 bottles made. That one won gold medal at the 2007 Malt Maniac Award. So clearly had a lot of credibility and a lot of very qualified malt enthusiasts speaking for it. So I finally decided on that one kind of as the crown jewel. And then followed closely by that Lagavulin 21-year-old, the original 1985 vintage, as I mentioned earlier. One I was incredibly lucky to find, and this was almost a fluke, I sourced this from the U.S. actually, is the Bullmore 34-year-old 1971, which was an official bottling sherried at 51%. So those are those were kind of my trinity, and then followed closely. It's weird to say that because, you know, in fourth place comes the Ardbeg 1975 to 1998 official bottling, and most people would put a 75 Ardbeg at the top of pretty much any list. But in this company, you know, it's, let's just say it's in very good company. I also did pick a Port Ellen 25, Douglas Lane Platinum Old and Rare for Potsdale. And this was in an Isla, but I also got the Talisker 35-year-old 2012, which was a Diageo special release from last year. So that was the representative from Skye.
Now, if I remember right, the Port Ellen 25-year-old was picked for another special reason too, right?
Oh, yes. Thanks for reminding me. That one was distilled in 1979, and that is the year of the groom's birth. And so back to the piece I was talking about earlier in terms of the different criteria for my choices, I did want to pick a bottle both from the year that the groom was born and the year that the bride was born. And so there were certainly other Port Ellens and Broras I would have kind of slotted in about that region on my list. But when I saw that 79 Port Ellen, and again, a highly rated bottle according to the Malt Maniacs and others, it seemed like a perfect grab for me.
Well, let's go to the Highlands now. What'd you pick in the Highlands region?
Okay, for the Highlands, I had a lot of fun for all of this, but the one that I'm most looking forward to myself is the Kleinliesch 17-year-old official bottling manager's dram, which is a sherry cask, and that rings in at 61.8%. So that's going to be, I think that's going to be quite a whiskey to enjoy. Some of the ones I got locally, because they were easy to source and would fit in nicely into the lineup, I did choose a Balvenie 30 year. I chose a Glenmorangie 25 quarter century, a Glendronach 31-year-old Grandeur, and a Glenor 30. And a couple others. Yeah, the list goes on and on. I got a Longmore 1971 heavily sherried Gordon MacPhail, a Glenfarclas 1986 family cask. Now that's where the bride comes in, because the bride was born in 1986. So that bottling of the family cask, I've personally owned a bottle and enjoyed it greatly. So that was kind of an honor of the bride. And I also did pick up a Glenlivet 25, because I figured that was a name amongst the others that might be more familiar to some of the party guests.
You didn't pick many silent stills, though. I think Rosebank was the only one you picked that was a closed distillery, right?
Yep, correct. I didn't really make that much of a criteria. Were I to be making this list for myself, if somebody were to come to me and say, here's $10,000, buy for yourself, I would have probably pursued more silent stills. I might have pursued more independent bottlings. I kind of just naturally gravitated towards a lot of these, as you may have noticed, are official bottlings. One last one I didn't mention in the island category was the Highland Park 40, which I found a fairly nice deal over in the UK at a different vendor and was able to get that one ordered and shipped. So it just, for some reason, considering that the audience for this are going to be 220-some wedding guests. This is actually for a pre-party for the wedding. The night before the wedding, they're having what John calls a monster party at his house, where basically everybody invited to the wedding gets to come to the party. And so there's going to be a lot of people there. And so rather than, for example, I'm more than happy in any of the Scotch flights I lead or the educational things I do to explain to people the difference between an independent bottler and what cask strength is and things like that. But kind of for this list, I guess it kind of made sense that most of these bottles would fall into the official bottling category. There are a few indies just because, for example, you're not really going to find an older Longmorn, especially an older sherried Longmorn. You're not going to find an official bottling because that's mostly used in blends. I didn't lean towards silent stills like I might have if I was building adding to my own collection. I just kind of looked more towards a range of styles and whiskeys, largely official bottlings that I thought would kind of represent a good range of tastes and introductions, so I could tell somebody, oh, if you like the Macallan 18, let me have you try the Glendronach 31-year-old, for example, or perhaps the Glenfarclas family cask. So that's kind of why I took that approach.
So how are you going to vet who gets to go into the secret room with all the good stuff? Because I know you picked out a bunch of the more common single malts to sort of test people with, right?
Yes. There have been, there's been a lot of emails going around, some humorous and some not. And frankly, at times it's a little hard for me to tell, who's joking and who's not on the other end of the line, because we've talked about having trials, whereby they have to, I made a joke about lining up on a table things like a bowl of ice, a can of Coke, a bottle of soda, a bowl of lemon slices, and a pipette in a little glass of cool, clean water, and they have to choose the one implement appropriate for, enhancing a scotch, and anybody who reaches in the wrong direction doesn't get in. We joked about having people with sashes and helmets, you know, with holding John's father's World War II bayonet as a guard at the door. So we've talked about printing up special invitations and handing them out to only those we think would most appreciate it. So I think the bottom line is that, you know, anybody who feels, you know, the need to go in and sample a nice scotch will probably be allowed to. I mean, part of the joke is it's been called a secret scotch room. But, you know, then now we have, he has some hats printed out that say, ask me about the secret scotch room, and sashes that say, secret scotch room guard. They're literally sashes like you would see at a beauty contest for the guards to wear outside the door. So it's all very, very tongue-in-cheek. It's all very open and friendly. But, you know, it is true that there will be, you know, limited pours to a limited amount of people. We're not just going to open, you know, Lefroy 27-year-old and be pouring, you know, low balls full of it. I had John buy a couple cases of some of the Glencairn glasses and also like a small case of watch glasses, so we can show people how to pour a little bit in the glass and cap it to build up the nose and the essence of the whiskey in the glass, and then, you know, and then take a smell and maybe one drop of water to see if it opens, excuse me, things like that. So, you know, it's still, to be honest, a little clear to me in terms of what enforcement, if any, there will be to get in the room. But all I know is it's going to be a lot of fun. I think we'll probably have a few jokes. They may have to learn how to, they may have to pronounce Lefroy properly, for example. And, you know, and I'll also be officiating, so I'll make sure that, you know, I'll be doing the pours, and I've got a little 1 ounce jigger to make sure that, you know, portions don't get too big, and to make sure nobody, you know, slams the whiskey to see how it tastes or something like that. So I think we'll have a system in place to make sure people properly enjoy the whiskeys, but that, you know, anybody who wants to taste a legendary scotch should be able to do so.
Provided they're invited to the wedding, of course.
Provided they're inviting the wedding. That's probably the second biggest joke that has appeared on Facebook and elsewhere is, you know, I must have misplaced my invitation, or, you know, this is the one wedding to crash, things like that. So, yeah, definitely there are a lot of people, I think, who wish they could be there. So I'm really looking forward to presiding over it and, you know, having a chance to, as tour guide, to take the tour myself.
So, without being presumptuous, what's in this for you other than just getting to have a lot of fun that night?
Well, that's a great question. Paul has also been very instrumental in helping out with parts of this wedding. And so at one point, John did reach out to me and said, you know, I want to be clear and direct. I want to thank you and Paul both for helping me out for everything you're doing. You know, would you like to, you know, select any one of the bottles already ordered, you know, as a gift, or maybe, you know, have us order some more. And so, you know, I had already given so much thought to setting up this lineup, it didn't, you know, really make sense to me to kind of pick from the, you know, to pick from the collection. So I said, well, you know, given the range of some of the bottles we've been buying, if I were to choose one crown jewel for myself, it would probably be this one. And so what I selected is a fairly legendary bottle. It was an Ardbeg 1975 official bottling for Velier Italy sherry cask at 47.6%. And this one was, I actually put out a internal poll with the Malt Maniacs and said it was between that or getting another bottle of that Lefroy 27, because I knew for myself I wanted a sherry Isla. And it came back very lopsided. I think it was like 20-2 in favor of the Ardbeg. So I said, okay. So I was able to order up the Ardbeg for myself, and then for Paul, I ordered up another one of the Talisker 35 2012, as well as an Ardbeg 1977. So, you know, in addition to the joy of simply being a part of this event and being asked to do it, it is a labor of love. Anybody who loves whiskey can probably understand what it'd be like to get, you know, be given an unfettered budget practically to buy some world-class malts. I would have likely done it just for the love of it, but, you know, when asked to select a fine bottle as a thank you gift, you know, I really couldn't. That was an offer I couldn't refuse.
One final question.
Yes.
Does John's wife know about this?
Oh, absolutely.
And how much you're spending?
Yeah, she's been a big part of it. That's another kind of common question. You know, none of this is in secret. It's, in fact, I think, from what I understand, she's also a big part of the enthusiasm because, again, this is their one daughter. They really are looking forward to having a kind of a beautiful ceremony, and they want everything to go right. And a part of everything is a Scotch room, and so she understands that, you know, they're setting up a pretty special Scotch event for their guests at her event. So yeah, she's been on board and part of this from the start. In fact, she sent an email joking saying, if I can get a hold of some of the invitations to the secret Scotch room, can I sell them on the black market? So she knows what's going on, and she's part of the fun, and that just makes it, you know, that makes it all the more fun.
Now, there are no tickets for the secret Scotch room available on the internet. In fact, the location of the party is a closely guarded secret. Believe me, if I could get in, I'd be on a plane to Minnesota. That's this week's WhiskeyCast In Depth, brought to you by Woodford Reserve. Discover Woodford Reserve Double Oaked, uniquely matured in two separate new white oak barrels, the second deeply toasted and lightly charred for a more complex dimensional flavor. Find out more at woodfordreserve.com. Be double sure. Drink responsibly. Woodford Reserve Double Oaked, Kentucky Straight Bourbon Whiskey, 45.2% alcohol by volume. Woodford Reserve Distillery, Versailles, Kentucky. I like Rich's goal of quality instead of quantity, so there's just one whiskey in the What I'm Tasting This Week department, but it's a good one. The 12th annual release of Port Ellen from the Classic Malts Special Releases series. This one was distilled in 1979 and bottled last year at 32 years old and at 52.5% ABV. The nose is very aromatic with a mild peatiness, burning driftwood smoke, brine, ginger, nutmeg, and almond notes. The taste is smoky and spicy with intense pepperiness and a good peaty touch, wood smoke and hints of brine and ginger in the background. The finish is very long with subtle spices, a kiss of wood smoke, and turns dry with hints of fruit as it fades. I'm scoring the Port Ellen 12th Annual Release a 93. I've added it to the searchable notes for nearly 1,000 different whiskeys at WhiskeyCast.com. That's also where you'll find WhiskeyCast HD and WhiskeyCast Virtual Tastings episodes, the calendar of events, your voice, and much, much more. Don't forget, every month one of our registered members at the website wins a free print from the WhiskeyCast Photo Gallery. There's still time to register in time for June's drawing. The address is WhiskeyCast.com, and my email address for questions and suggestions is comments@WhiskeyCast.com.
WhiskeyCast, proudly brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Join the stillhouse at singlepotstill.com and receive an exclusive whiskey tasting journal.
WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2013, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.